Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand, the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's freaking gorgeous down here. It's even Fukushima irradiated. I was talking to my friend Jonathan Eisen from Uncensored magazine this morning, and it turns out that the old Fukushima radiation is a really bad thing indeed. Not only are people getting radiation poisoning in the continental US and Alaska now, reports have been coming out, but he believes that the worst of the radiation plume is now on its way to little old New Zealand, which I think will improve the economy because now everybody will be able to get a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest today is, if I'm not mistaken, Tony Farrell from is it the TonyFarrellReport.com or something? Tony, are you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Oh, that's great, Vinny. Sorry, we couldn't get the webcam working.
Yeah, we've got your JPEGs.
Okay, that's fine.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do, and of course, make sure you plug your website and any products that the listeners might be interested in.
Okay, then. Well, I've been on your show before about 18 months ago, Vinny, just shortly after I was chucked out of the police force in UK. In fact, it's probably the police force that at the moment currently stands as having the worst reputation, and that's regarding the 24-year cover-up of the Hillsborough disaster, in which 96 people lost their lives in a FA Cup semi-final, and the police covered it up. Anyway, this organisation, South Yorkshire Police, threw me out of the organisation for telling the truth and speaking truth to power on the terror threat when I refused to bear false witness. Now, I went through a little bit of that on your first show. I've since had a very interesting journey in taking my former organisation, South Yorkshire Police, through the UK court system in the employment tribunal process, where I've tried to defeat them for a discrimination and unfair dismissal. Now, that's gone to the highest point possible in the Royal Court of Justice in the UK, and has been closed down by Lady Dame Janet Smith. Now, Lady Dame Janet Smith, who refused to look at the analysis and the evidence, and all along, all the court process has sidestepped ever looking at the evidence that was available by way of analysis. Lady Dame Janet Smith is now presiding over perhaps what is the most famous case, or threatens to be the most famous case in UK history, which is the cover-up of Jimmy Savile, which is the BBC's involvement with Jimmy Savile and paedophilia. Now, for listeners in New Zealand, that might not mean a lot, but Jimmy Savile was an immensely popular figure in the United Kingdom, a figurehead in the BBC for doing good deeds and also chairing Top of the Pops. So the same judge that, in a way, corruptly threw my case out and refused to look at the evidence about the London bombings and 9/11 and the bogus terror threat that exists within the United Kingdom and demonises the Muslims unfairly, is the same judge that now is going to preside over this case. That's a very important case, because what's happening in the UK is that the paedophile networks that exist, and these aren't your Dirty Mac Brigade, these are people in high places in the judiciary, in the police service, etc., etc. This now is in serious danger of breaking out and being exposed for all it's worth. So I've had a very interesting journey, but what I wanted to talk about more about today is a particular case that I've been coming involved with over the last year. It's virtually a year that I've been involved in this case, which I believe links in some way to the 7/7 bombings, in some way to what happened 2 weeks after the 7/7 bombings, which was the assassination of Jean-Charles de Menezes, the Brazilian, who was an innocent victim who had 7 bullets put through his head at the underground station at Stockwell. And this case is about a court procedure, which I've entitled in the Farrell Report as a monstrous cover-up in the judiciary. And it involves a lady called Miss Charles Seven. And it spans a decade, the case. And it is, in my opinion, as a former principal intelligence analyst, one of the most compelling cases that reveals court corruption and gives the compelling evidence that has an opportunity to expose the judicial system in the UK for all it's worth. It also gives a very good insight into how the media and entertainment industry can perpetrate events and stage manage these kind of false flag operations to fool and dupe the public. So in essence, Vinny, that's what I would like to sort of talk about in the first instance on your programme today. And thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, before you go on and talk about it, would you please just enlighten us as to your website so people who are listening in can go and check that out while they're doing it?
Yes, certainly. If people go to the farrellreport.net, that's the farrellreport.net, there contains within that umpteen different videos that I have made since losing my job in South Yorkshire Police, and a full account of Miss Seven's case against Gossage and 9 others, which I believe is absolutely critical. There's 7 domains on the left-hand side of that website, and you can, if you want to look at Miss Seven's case, you can download the report. It's a 240-page report. But you can go to conclusion and see for yourself what that entails. And you can also signpost the umpteen videos that have been made about my court case, about the London bombing, 7/7 in 2005, and about the whole stories. And my experience of confronting South Yorkshire police, where I've done many adventurous things, such as standing on a mountaintop with a megaphone to actually expose and wake up the masses in the United Kingdom about the corruption within our police state UK.
I found it's very difficult to wake people up with a megaphone unless you're outside their bedroom.
That's right, yeah. But you've got to use your imagination somehow, though, Vinny, haven't you?
I mean, well, hey, if you can't use your imagination, are you really human at all?
Yeah, good point. So, I'd encourage listeners to go onto the farrellreport.net website and just have a browse. There's plenty of material there to have a look at.
Okay. So let's get on with it, because we've got a number of topics to cover. The Jimmy Savile pedophile scandal, the 7/7 false flag terrorist attack, and police corruption in the UK and demonising Muslims. I mean, where would you like to begin?
Well, I'd like to start with Miss Seven's case, because, if I may, Miss Seven was an inventor of concepts. And in the early 2000s, she put together a remarkable package of concepts that would revolutionise and transform the entertainment industry. Now, she put 24 shows together, or concepts, and she took these to be protected, copyrighted, copyright protection, to a big media law firm in London. And the bottom line is, they breached her confidence, put her in touch without her consent to big media moguls within the UK industry. Now, we're talking in terms of NTL, which are now currently Virgin Media, and big law firms in the United Kingdom. And before she knew it, she had about a dozen or so of these concepts stolen away from her, and then, when, you know, in a blink of an eye, these concepts have been transformed into big TV programmes that are going out on the British Broadcasting Company, that's the BBC, Independent Television, that's ITV, and one of the programmes, for instance, Strictly Come Dancing, which she'd taken as copyright, went all over the world in at least 14 other countries. Now, when she then, having had that stolen and became distressed, she went to a different solicitor who, the first one having breached her confidence, the second solicitor, a massive law firm in the United Kingdom, did the very same thing again. And they stole a second suite of concepts from her. So instead of helping her out against the previous lawyers that had betrayed her, they did the same again. And the thing is, the third solicitor she went to when she was betrayed a second time, the third solicitor betrayed her. And all in all, there are about 24 concepts that were stolen from her. Now, the remarkable thing about this case is that when she started to take them on single-handedly as a litigant in person in the courts, we have an extraordinary case of courtroom and judicial corruption that beggars belief. Now, she started this courtroom saga in 2004, and against all kinds of court obstruction, she got a substantive hearing in at the time of the London bombings, which is July 2005. But coincided with all that, massive gang stalking of Miss Seven occurred by the state apparatus. Now, we're talking levels that are unprecedented. Death threats, burglaries, computer hacking, all sorts of things were going on against Miss Seven, that she went to the police in the month before the London bombings saying that, "Hey, listen, I understand the code that these media moguls are operating to, and they are clearly advertising in plain sight that something dreadful is going to happen in July 2005. And I want an injunction put out against these meagre moguls who are advertising it in plain sight to try and stop them from doing this." Now, not surprisingly,
what kind of, What kind of advertising of 7/7 does she believe that they were doing?
Well, she was seeing it in... First of all, she was seeing a lot of circumstantial signs, such as Muslims were outside her house. But in the media, she was seeing adverts that there's no escaping it. July in magazines that were controlled by the media moguls that had conned her out of her concepts. But the final straw, and there was time and time again, this was happening in the lead up to the 2007 bombings. But what was the final straw in terms of her own insight and understanding the code was the film to do with the Wachowski brothers. And this was a film that was purporting to actually be... It was called Viva Vendetta. Not that wasn't written by the Wachowski brothers, but this film was advertising that they were going to do something on the London Underground. Now, this film didn't come out until 2006, but it was advertised in June 2005, a month before the bombings. Now, Miss Seven had a link with Sophia Stewart from America. Sophia Stewart has taken... for copyright infringement, the Wachowski brothers, for the stealing of her concepts to do with the Matrix movie. So, Whether Miss Seven was right in her thinking or not, undoubtedly she can prove that this is what she believed and this is what she did. So she understood this kind of code that they were operating to such an extent that she went into hiding in at the beginning of July 2007 in her own flat, barricading herself in because she dare not go out because of the death threats and the stalking, which was immense at this time. So she stayed inside, and lo and behold, what she saw was on the 7th of July 2005, she saw the London bombings occur. What's more, her street in London has nothing to do with any of the stations where the London bombings occurred. Yet, the BBC reporting of the event took place on her street. And there's seven houses on each side of her street. Now, also, the bogus hoax demands for council tax payment were shoved underneath her floor, on the third floor of her apartment. Well, it shouldn't have been broken. It shouldn't have been eligible to get in anyway. But they were shoved under her door with the date 7/7 on. So she...
Hold on a second, Tony. We're coming to break. We'll be right back. Tony Farrell, ladies and gentlemen.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise, always gonna be a surprise, 'cause we don't know.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Tony Farrell, talking about an awful lot of very, very nasty things. Now, Tony, it always impresses me when you see somebody who used to be part of the establishment, such as a police officer or something of that nature, who wakes up, comes over to the other side, because often they're some of the most effective people at exposing them because they've been trained how to expose and how to investigate, right?
That's correct, yes. And I was a
principal intelligence officer. How do your former colleagues feel about what you're doing?
Well, South Yorkshire Police tend to blank me, with the exception of the police chaplain. When I say blank me, there's one or two former police officers that will engage with me. But, for instance, in other police forces, I'm received very warmly on the streets. One of the things I did was hand myself in for arrest under Section 15, Article 3 of the Terrorism Act at West Midlands Police, which is some considerable distance away from South Yorkshire, because I wanted to turn the legislation back on their own head and saying that I've paid money to council tax that goes directly to South Yorkshire Police, and they're complicit in the concealment of 7/7. And instead of getting a frosty response, they refused to arrest me. They did take me in for questioning voluntarily. And at the end of it, five officers shook my hands and wished me all the best. Also in the Metropolitan Police, I'm familiar with officers who are really doing their level best to expose paedophilia networks that are going on at the length and breadth of this country, but are getting blocked by the hierarchy within the police service. So one or two people, more than one or two people, many police officers are actually grateful for the stance I've made. I only wish that other principal intelligence analysts would follow suit.
And have any of them actually followed in terms of actually giving support? Because being in the position I'm in on radio, many, many people say keep up the good work. And it's only a small, dedicated group of people who actually do something to help you keep up the good work, as it were.
Yeah, a few walk the talk, I'm afraid. People are more concerned with the livelihood and the very decent pension that police get, so they don't want to spoil that. So unfortunately, they do not walk the talk. My own organisation went with a mantra, justice with courage. But basically what they did to me was injustice without courage.
Mm. How do you feel about that?
Sad, but we just move on, don't we? We've got, you know, each has his own conscience to examine. And we're all answerable, I believe, to a higher being, and that on the day of judgment, at least on this instance, I've got no regrets for doing the right thing. Next month, on the 26th of May, I've become bankrupt. But it means nothing now. It really doesn't. I would have had sleepless nights. I would have hated myself if I had have weaseled out of telling the truth on the 7th of July 2010, which was coincidentally the fifth anniversary of 7/7, when I made my stance. And I'm glad I did, despite losing everything.
So you'd rather have nothing except a clear conscience?
Absolutely. I have felt liberated. Now, that's not to say, Vinny, that I haven't felt fear in the past, but by faith, I feel as though I've acted in accordance with my conscience, and I've been blessed accordingly. And I wouldn't change this journey that I've been on, despite all the hardship, despite the prospect of losing all my material possessions. What profits a man if he gain the whole world yet lose his soul, is the mantra I would go through, the scripture. So I'm content and I'm at peace, irrespective of everything that's gone on.
Okay. All right, now we cut you off before the break, and you were explaining something, but I can't quite remember exactly what.
Well, Miss Seven's case, we were talking, linking it to Seven. There's just one other link, because 2 weeks later, John Charles de Menzies, I don't know whether people in New Zealand know about this, but he was an innocent Brazilian that was followed down the escalator in the underground station in London at Stockwell. And then when he got on the tube station, the security services jumped on him as a potential suspect bomber and put seven bullets through his head. Now, there was a monstrous cover-up over that. High-ranking police officers lied through their back teeth. And what was interesting on that, Miss Seven made the link with the seven bullets through the head. Another thing on that was that there was an operation, Operation Kratos, which was training police how to deal with suspect Islamic terrorists and how to bring them down. But it was all ludicrous. And it happened, the 22nd of July 2005 was exactly 911 days after the origins of Operation Kratos. So Miss Seven, again, legitimately made that link because her family name was Jean Charles. And the individual that we had assassinated in cold-blooded murder was Jean-Charles de Menzies. So there was another connection. Now, I wanted to move on a little bit because the real crux of the matter with Miss Seven's case is the utter court corruption that ensued. She should have had a case in July 2005, but because she was hit inside, it got stayed. She eventually got it back on track in June 2006, not without all sorts of obstructions within the courtroom back office. Nevertheless, she got it there. And she, in front of a Judge Pumphrey, who is now dead unexpectedly, she, by all accounts, had the case won, and it was heading to a criminal trial where there were 10 major defendants. And we're talking big players here in the media industry and the law firms. And she the audio tapes are available. Now, she undoubtedly was heading towards victory as a result of the audio tapes that you can audibly hear. What subsequently ensued after the hearing ended was no such judgment came about. The judgment that was issued was couldn't have been more polarised from what actually happened in the three-day hearing. So it was all corrupt. Now, Judge Pumphrey was nowhere to be seen then. He was silent. He then got promoted rapidly, shortly after. He then got knighted. And then a month after he was knighted, he was found unexpectedly on Christmas Eve, dead, alone. Right? And what Miss Seven was able to do, despite having spending 18 months trying to contact him to get the court transcripts and trying to get some satisfactory explanation as to why the judgment was a reverse of every utterance that he made in the hearing and was unsuccessful at that. Once Pumphrey died, another good judge came along and released the audio tapes of the hearing with Pumphrey in 2006. And this offers damning, compelling evidence about the court skullduggery. And this is the key, and this is why I've stuck by the case. Because armed with the audio tapes, Miss Seven then took the case, and in a hearing before Lord Justice Lawrence Collins in September 2008, what happened was that Lord Justice Collins shut the case down and refused to allow Miss Seven, as a litigant in person, to even mention the audio tapes or even mention the hearing before before Judge Pumphrey. Now, one word about Judge Pumphrey and what he said about Seven, he said in terms of intellectual property theft, he said that Miss Seven's case was by far and away the best case he'd ever seen, the best prepared documents by any litigant in person in all his career as a judge. And he had no doubt that was copyright, and no doubt that this case against 10 high-profile, big-reputation defendants was going to head for a criminal trial. So here we have loads of evidence that shows the cover-up in the British judicial system in the high courts. What subsequently happened is that Miss Seven, having lost the case in 2008 because it got killed stone dead by a corrupt judge, Lawrence Collins, subsequently exposed it for all it's worth. And in 2000, I met Seven on the 1st of May last year outside a protest to the abolition of the Independent Police Complaints Commission, who were utterly corrupt and completely fail to investigate any police wrongdoing, that's what their purpose is. I subsequently reacquainted myself or tried to get contact with Miss Seven on the 17th of May 2012, only to be told that two of her dear friends that had supported her had died that day independently. Now, the next time I had an opportunity to speak to Miss Seven, it became clear to me that rather than these unexpected deaths just happening by sheer coincidence, it's my probability assessment, very strong probability assessment, but both these gentlemen who were supportive of Miss Seven and were helping her to expose this case that they must keep quiet, were whacked. Right? So we're talking a judge that was possibly whacked. We're talking two of her supporters that were whacked. We're talking Jean-Charles de Menzies, potentially, that was singled out because they were using Miss Seven, I believe, as an exquisite torment. Miss Seven has perhaps misstated the motives by saying that they did it to cover up her case. That's 7-7. No, they didn't. 7-7 was perpetrated long before July 2005, the planning of it, that is. It was already on Panorama in May, back in May 2004, where it was the replica of what was going to happen was actually being shown on BBC, and they were going to blame the Muslims and the media would control everything. However, what I believe has happened here is that the golden goose, Miss Seven, who's brought the millions of pounds with her stolen concepts that have gone all over the world, was also used as an exquisite torment by these evil monsters to advertise, hidden in plain sight, their motives and what they were about to do in the London Underground, as if it was a taunt, as to say, we're going to do this, we're going to use your name, and we're going to actually taunt you, taunt the living hell out of you, and we're going to do it brazenly. So they've done this as an exquisite torment. The actual torment has not ceased, because in writing the report that's on the website, the Farrell Report, 240-page, without even counting the appendices, and there are many appendices, I stayed in her flat alone and over the Christmas period this year, and between the 18th and the 23rd of January this year, I endured the kind of gang stalking that Miss Seven had actually told me about, the kind of things she was enduring for the last decade. What I mean by that was that right across the road, there was a whole corridor on the third floor of a block apartment in London that was actually surveying me, and that they were making it brazen. When I went outside the apartment, they were following me, they were videoing me. Now, interestingly, when the report came out, and the report broke out on the UK column, which is a big alternative media news broadcasting company that exposes the truth here in the UK, when news broke out about that, a week or two later, what happens? The whole of the floor of that operation, where all the surveillance on that, that was zooming in on my on Seven's property, where I was staying, writing my report alone, was burnt to the floor. Not only that, on the same day it was burnt to the floor, advertisements appeared all over London on the Underground and on the bus shelters, which were to do with Strictly Come Dancing, the very concept that Miss Seven had stolen from her several years before. And that on that advertisement, it was entitled Strictly Come Dancing, Burn the Floor. And that's the very thing that they did as an extra taunt to Miss Seven. But I've experienced this with Miss Seven in recent times by being involved in jointly writing the report with her. And what's more, I can witness now that there's been 65 occasions when Miss Seven, as a targeted individual, a chronic repeat victim, has been to the police pleading for help. This goes back a decade. And you know what, Vinny? Not a single attempt to investigate her case properly has actually been forthcoming from the Metropolitan Police Service. It's an utter disgrace. Their abject failure to deal with the criminality on show in this case is beyond belief. Now, what I hope is that with this case that we've got, because we've got the evidence of the court corruption, that it has the potential to do serious damage to the establishment and bring down high-profile reputations. And we're talking about a lawyer that stole her, the second strand, that stole her work, called Tamsin Allen, for instance, who was seconded to the Leveson inquiry. The Leveson inquiry, by Lord Leveson, was all about police hacking, News of the World hacking, Rupert Murdoch's hacking, and the police involvement with that. So,
well, Tony, we're coming to another break. So, hold that thought. And we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Tony Farrell at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain
welcome
air,
back.
Man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand. My very special guest is Tony Farrell. Tony, welcome back.
Thank you, please. Yeah, well, I was talking just before the break about the Leveson inquiry and a solicitor called Tamsin Allen, who had risen to the dizzy heights and has just been awarded a super lawyer status in London. Now, the thing about Tamsin Allen is she was one of the defendants, the 10 defendants in Miss Seven's case, who was responsible directly from stealing the concept off Miss Seven on the second tranche of concepts that she had when she went for her for help against the previous solicitor. So this is a characteristic, a feature of what happens in the corruption in the UK, that lowly people or people quickly get promoted for being corrupt and actually following this state apparatus agenda. And we're talking, when we look at connections with Seven's case and the London bombings, we're talking about Lord Justice Lawrence Collins, who was the first ever lawyer that made his way all. He had five promotions that coincided with Miss Seven's case, where he ended up to be in the House of Lords. We're talking about police officers such as Sir Ian Blair and Cressida Dick, who got promoted three times for the cover-up of 7-7 and Jean-Charles de Menzies. And then when they fall in disrepute, they're allowed to retire on a pension and nothing else is heard of it. But the fact that they've been involved in the perpetration, the countenance, the perpetration of the corruption within, is quickly forgotten by the British public. And what's sad is that the people in the United Kingdom are not appalled by all of this in sufficient numbers to have an impact. And that's very sad. One thing that I've been trying to do is target the Muslim community with talks. And I recently did a talk into one of the biggest mosques in the United Kingdom, which is at Southampton. And I did a talk in front of around 200 Muslims. And in that talk, I spoke about the bogus terror threat. I spoke about the fact that Muslims are being demonised by our corrupt establishment, and that the police are playing their major part in that. I myself mentioned the contest strategy, which is the counter-terrorism strategy here in the UK, which I described to them as a contempt strategy rather than a contest strategy, that was deliberately allocating blame, apportioning blame to Muslims for the 7-7 attacks and 9-11 attacks, as we know, but also there was umpteen examples of miscarriages of justice against Muslims under the draconian terrorism legislation that we're bringing in. And my dilemma is, somebody who is a non-Muslim, in talking to them, but I do have faith, was that the Quran compels Muslims to speak the truth. So I said, why on earth are you taking the rap for the London bombings and other miscarriages of justice regarding a terror threat and not speaking up against it? What does the Quran, the real Quran, compel you to do? And I asked them to put their hand up if anybody in that mosque believed that 7-7 was committed and 9-11 was committed by 23 Muslim suicidal maniacs. And everybody within that mosque, both ladies and gentlemen, actually agreed with me that they didn't believe that to be the case. So they were openly expressing in the confines of a mosque that, no, we never did. Muslims didn't do this, even though it was portrayed as Muslim. This was done in the name of Islam. However, they were all so fearful in the United Kingdom of actually going out and putting the head above the parapet and speaking out. And I said, as a somebody who has had the Christian faith, I said, how on earth can you expect Christians to come to your aid if you yourself and actually accepting, by your own admission, responsibility in open, in an open way. Yet secretly, you know that you didn't. Your own scripture compels you to tell the truth on this. And I think that was encouraging words for Muslims to hear. But there is this horrible fear factor within the Muslims who are being demonised in the United Kingdom. And what we need is that, you know, Muslims aren't at loggerheads with the Christians in the United Kingdom, or they shouldn't be. The real enemy here within is the Zionists. And that we need, and that needs to be addressed full on. The individuals who are in control of the establishment, the judiciary, and at the higher echelons of the police service need exposing for all they're worth. I don't believe, for instance, in UK policing, that the vast majority of police officers join the service with good intentions. And we've got to get to win the hearts and minds of those people, those police officers, if they are going to turn round their own organisation from within. Because we are dependent on the police service, whether we like it or not. And in its current format, it is, together with the judiciary, a real threat to civil liberties within our society.
Now, can you think about a particular methodology that would perhaps govern these particular institutions, whether it be that the judiciary, the government, or the police themselves, to prevent any similar things from happening in future? What kind of regulations would have to be put in place? Or would it simply be more the fact that, hey, you need to teach people to stand up for what is right and expose people as they come along?
Well, exposure is they fear exposure. I mean, in my case, Ephesians 5:11 says, "Have nothing to do with the fruitless words of darkness, but come out and expose," which is exactly, in a way, what I've tried my level best to do. And I think we don't tackle this aggressively. We tackle this with a spirit of love and peace. And that, yes, we expose. Yes, we do not tolerate. We do not tolerate evil within our midst, and we expose it for all it's worth. But that said, we don't wrongfully blame an organisation, a proportion of which potentially good people who we could win the hearts and minds over. And if we, I think a lot are still blind. The problem within the police service, for instance, is that you've got things like common purpose, you've got things like secret societies, and you've got a construct there that is designed to pigeonhole the mindset into what the government would want you to understand. And I myself experienced that as a principal intelligence analyst until it dawned on me that there was another world out there, a truth movement, and that ever since I've moved out, I know a lot more about police corruption than I ever did when I was within the service for all that time, and I was in the service for 17 years. So the main thing here is that we've got to keep exposing. We've got to be...
Hold on just a second here. You're in the service for 17 years and you didn't notice any corruption going on within it?
No, I know. I'm not saying I didn't know. No, I'm not saying I didn't notice corruption. I'm saying, compared with the corruption I see outside, having become a little bit of a magnet to people telling me what kind of corruption and bringing cases to me, compared to the access I was given as a principal intelligence analyst within the police service. Bear in mind, a principal intelligence analyst post is not a police officer post, it's a civilian post.
Ah.
I'm saying the comparison between the two is such that I know far more now, almost 20, 30 times more than I ever did within the police. It's not that I didn't see corruption, it's that I see far more corruption now because I'm not shackled, I'm not handcuffed by their own mind control systems. I've broken free of that. And that is a liberating thing. And as a result of breaking free of that and actually becoming a magnet, I feel that it's almost my calling to speak out against the police. And for that reason, I've tried to make umpteen videos exposing the corruption from within. Now, all these, you know, the internet is awash with serious videos exposing corruption. There's no shortage of them. I've tried to make my videos a little bit different, for instance, to capture a different kind of audience. And I'll give you, if I may, I'll give you one example. I made a satire together with Dr. Nick Collistrom, who's written a book, Beneath the Veil of 7-7, exposing the deceit behind the official narrative. Now, in that video, it's a satire. It's not a full documentary as such. It's a satire based on the film They Live, and also based on two Shakespearean characters that featured in a Tom Stoppard play back in the 60s called Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. So we entitled our play Collistrum and Farrell Are Dead, and we used a pack of cards, 52, just like to name and shame who we believe were chief perpetrators and architects behind the perpetration and the cover-up of the 7-7 London bombing. And it's quite entertainment. It also can be found on the Farrell Report website. And it's very different in its style, and therefore has an appeal to a different kind of audience over and above the very serious documentaries that have been made about the London bombing.
Well, you know, I've always been a big fan of kind of looking on the lighter side of genocide and doing a bit of tongue-in-cheek, because sometimes when you're serious, you don't get people interested. But if you're funny, you do. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com with Tony Farrell.
Disinformation to bed, check the labels, delete the virus, alert the masses.
Ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide. Because the world's so full of chaos and madness and scumbaggery and people getting whacked whenever they expose some other form of scumbag, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. Speaking of which, learning about the New World Order and the assassinations of decent people and so on and so forth, umpteen millions of conspiracies that are probably out there that we just haven't even discovered yet, I found myself questioning my sanity somewhat and think to myself, oh my God, is this real? Or is this just some kind of a made-up matrix designed to make me go frickin' nuts? And the unfortunate thing is, it's real. And it really does drive some people crazy. And the only way to really maintain one's sanity, I found, is to maintain some levity. What does it do? It provides relief in the face of certain death, basically. Tony Farrell is my very special guest. Welcome back.
Thank you, Benny.
Any thoughts on what I've just said there?
Yeah, I think putting in trying to have a sense of humour about this and actually presenting things in a more light-hearted light has an opportunity to win the hearts and minds of people that would otherwise be turned off and be so appalled by all of this that they can't even look at it. Miss Seven's case, for instance, is interesting because, and then one of the reasons why I stuck with it is because the stolen concepts concerned things that the British public, by and large, the ones that are tuned into the plug-in drug, the BBC television programmes on a Saturday evening, their beloved Strictly Come Dancing, if they ever thought, for instance, that that had been stolen from a victimised individual who's been gang-stalked for a decade in the process to keep it all hush-hush, they'd be appalled by that. Whereas, on the contrary, we can't wake them up on the horrors of 7-7, but it might have been been committed by the state apparatus. So I'm hoping that in a back-to-front way, we can use this case to actually wake up some of the masses that would be utterly appalled by the thought that their beloved TV programme has been stolen. And the second thing is, I'd add to your injection of humour and all of this, and you know, it's fantastic to talk with somebody so articulate as you are, Vinny, but I would add one thing that's personal to me, which is my complete faith in all of this. And I just want to, if I may, Vinny, can I just tell you a little bit of story in connection with 7?
Well, we have a whole hour, so go for it.
Well, I mentioned in the last half that two individuals that were very supportive of Miss 7 were whacked on the same day, which was the 17th of May 2012. That was the very day I made my second contact. I met her for the first time on May Day 2012, exchanged telephone numbers, and I happened to be, this is the story, on the 17th of May, you've interviewed this gentleman, it's called Moad Dib. You've had him on your show, and he's the maker of Ripple Effect 2 and Ripple Effect the Nazi Banksters, and I'd thoroughly recommend those programs to be searched by, and it's jforjustice.net.
Now, you can also, I got in contact with Moad Dib, and he allowed me to upload those videos to my channel as well. So if you click on the YouTube little thing on my website, thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, you can go there and search Moad Dib or 7-7, it should come up with it.
Right. Well, what happened is that just before Moad Dib completed his Ripple Effect 2 film, he was desperate to get a photograph of my boss, a DCI Steve Williams, who was down on the terror drill on the London bombings on that day. And he admitted that on the fifth. He admitted that to me on the fifth anniversary. Now, this was when there was a terror drill exercise with highly improbable coincidences that morphed into the real thing. So he clearly knew something that he wasn't prepared to let on. So in an effort to expose him, Moad Dib had instructed me from a base in Sheffield, right, South Yorkshire, to get a photograph so it could feature in the film. So for the best part of a day, I camped out in the bushes overlooking the professional standards unit of South Yorkshire Police until 7 p.m. in the evening, by which time the battery on my phone was exhausted, and therefore, and he was the last person still in the car park and never came out. So I failed to get DCI Steve Williams, but just before the battery went, I got a phone call out of the blue from Miss 7, and she then we made contact. And then when I went down to London to see about and look at all her case files, she told me the story about one of these two, well, about both these two gentlemen that died on that same day that she tried to make contact. And she told me an incredible story that had similar coincidences. And I'm going to share that story now, if I may. At the final hearing, when it got closed down in front of the corrupt judge, Lord Justice Lawrence Collins, Miss 7, armed with a team of 24 supporters in the court, or two dozen or so supporters in the courtroom, when she was witnessing Lord Justice Lawrence Collins corruptly closing the case down without enabling her to have any reference to Judge Pumphrey's earlier hearing, which she won, and he dismissed the case without merit, she watched behind the judge's head at the back of the courtroom walls, and this is how she described it to me, that she saw, coming through the walls in red ink, the words Mene, Mene, Tekel Upasin appear, and she was astounded. With her was one of these two gentlemen that died, who was a Christian pastor. And they were able to, afterwards, to explain what that meant. And it, if you've ever heard of the expression, the writing on the wall, many, many tekel of passing comes from Daniel 5 in the Bible, which is all about Belshazzar's feast, where the hand of God writes on the wall in the palace, many, many tekel of passing. And that evening, when Daniel explains what that all means, King Belshazzar actually meets his death. Now, Seven was telling me that particular story. Now, the reason why hairs on my back stood up with that is because just before I left Sheffield, South Yorkshire, and in order to meet with Miss Seven, I used to lead in a Bible study class, a small group, and the very last thing I led on was King Belshazzar's feast from Daniel 5 and the writing on the wall. So I felt that was a remarkable coincidence. And there are all sorts of circumstantial signs that I know I've had in this journey that prior to getting kicked out of the police force, where I was asked to make a stance in dreams without having any notion of what the New World Order was. So when the day came when I had my moment of decision on the fifth anniversary of the London bombings, when I woke up to 9/11 and 7/7 being inside jobs, it was the faith that gave me the courage, the faith through the circumstantial signs and the dreams it had. Now, none of that has abated since. It's continued. And I believe I've got a calling to help Miss Seven, because I believe Miss Seven's case is going to be immensely important in exposing the corrupt establishment. To have audio tapes for 3 days is unprecedented in the United Kingdom courts. And the extent to which it reveals and exposes the courtroom corruption at the highest levels and the abject failure of the Metropolitan Police to do anything about it is not to be scoffed at. I have sent this by email through all the European parliamentarians, all the parliamentarians in the UK and the Truth Movement. And we're trying to get it out as fast as possible. So thank you very much in this instance for helping us in terms of getting the exposure out there. But I do believe it's immensely important. But
well, you know, here's the thing, Tony. I was reading one of my YouTube comments earlier before the show. Me out protesting or whatever. And he said that, you'll never have any effect going out there and talking and broadcasting and so on and so forth, so why bother at all? And, you know, to an extent, I can see what he's talking about, because you think to yourself, well, how many people will listen to the show? I mean, 10,000 tops, maybe up to 100,000 or something of that nature. Off in some ethereal spacey land, listening to AM FM stations, which we can't measure. And I think about this, whether or not we're effective at exposing the truth by giving coverage to it, I think it's actually a misnomer and it's totally irrelevant. I think the whole point is just to do it, regardless of whether or not you're successful, because it's the right thing to do.
I agree entirely. We have got to be guided by each and every one of us by our own conscience. I mean, let's face it, we're confronted with it, utter evil all round. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil, for instance, as Burke would have it, was for good men to do nothing. And by good men, I mean women as well. So the evil part is to be, and what makes you complicit in this, is silence and burying your head in the sand. Each and every one of us are going to be answerable in one way or other. So it's a personal level. And I feel it's almost like I want to wake as many people up and tax their consciences. Whether they listen or not is entirely up to them. But if I feel as though I've been given a calling and been blessed to do that, then so be it. Whether it's not me that's going to make any difference, it will be in a higher power strength.
Here's another point. I also replied to this guy on the YouTube channel, right? And I said to him, look, mate, what you're doing is you're convincing yourself that doing something will accomplish nothing, and so then you choose to do nothing and accomplish exactly nothing. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
You know, don't you get it, people? The more you, the less that you do, the less you accomplish. If you do something, even if it's not like ridiculously effective and change the world, at least you're not doing nothing.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I think most people now, a lot of people now are waking up to issues like 9/11. We no longer ridicule when we shout 9/11 was an inside job. We no longer ridicule when we shout the London bombings, the Madrid bombings were all inside jobs. And, you know, in more recent times, we've got everything that's happened with the Boston Marathon. All evidence pointing towards false flag operations. And people are becoming increasingly alert to it. But it matters not how many people are alert to it. It's not what you think, it's what you do and whether you take action or not. And there's far too many people who are thinking, well, it's somebody else's business. And in the midst of evil, they are simply too scared to oppose. But men and women become complicit in the evil they fail to oppose, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I mean, I feel guilty if I don't do a show every day and expose at least just a little bit of scumbaggery. Like, you know how some people, they feel guilty about their health, like if they don't get their exercise for the day or whatever, they start feeling bad about themselves, like, oh man, I really should have gone for that run. It's like that with exposing scumbaggery for me. You know, it's part of your daily exercise regime, and if you don't expose at least a little bit of scumbaggery every day, it's like you become lazy. It's like you become fat. It's like you become what you hate and despise. How can people live with themselves if they're not exposing scumbaggery? I just don't get it.
Yeah. And one of the things that I'm just to tell you this little one. One of the things that I said on the minutes before I was dismissed from South Yorkshire Police, and it was on the 2nd of September 2010 that was my dismissal hearing. I said, the police service are about to nobble the wrong Tony, and South Yorkshire Police are going to make at risk of making themselves complicit in the evil deed and countenance the perpetuation of the murder of hundreds and thousands of women, of innocent women and children in the Middle East, if they sack me today. And they asked me who I meant by who's the other Tony then? And I said, well, isn't it obvious? It's Tony. I'm referring to Tony Blair, who was the chief architect on the war on terror, you know, which is utterly evil within, you know, grabbing our oil beneath their sand, so to speak, in the Middle East. It was all about resources, all done on the front of false pretense. So by doing it that way, when they sacked me, they were very respectful, they were very courteous, and they even thanked me and said I could be even useful to the police service. So the bottom line is here, I don't know what impact, if any, I'm having within the police service. I do know that the chaplain, the police chaplain at South Yorkshire Police, had a quiet word with me and says, boy, you ain't half creating a ripple effect at ACPO level in the police. Now, what do I mean by ACPO? That's the high-ranking officers, the chief constables, the deputies and the assistant chief constables throughout the length and breadth of the country, where we've got 43 police forces in the United Kingdom. So, you know, stand up against evil and shout from the rooftops is my motto. As I say, I've tried my best to shout from the rooftops because I've gone up on the cliff tops of Frogger Edge with a megaphone and put it on camera and tried to make it amusing in the process. Some short, sharp bursts of how I confront South Yorkshire Police, how I confront the evil within. It's how I, you know, how best I can operate. I haven't got the gift of the gab quite like you. I don't think I'd make a radio broadcaster like you can, Vinny, but I've got an imagination that can make films, or, you know, with the help of filmmakers who know what they're doing.
Yeah, well, I think that it's basically like you can do whatever you really want to, whatever tickles your fancy. I mean, I'm lucky enough to be born in as a multi-talented individual, so I can do radio, do music, do movies, write scripts and so on and so forth. You know, I can pretty much do whatever I like as long as it's some form of part to play in the entertainment game. But the ultimate thing is, whatever you feel comfortable with, whatever you feel that you're capable of doing, just go ahead and do it. You know, it's like, I don't know. Everybody's got some kind of a calling that forces them, compels them to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And if they don't do it, it kills you. We'll be right back.
Bonkers.
In my life ain't what it seems. I wake up just to go back to sleep. I act real shallow, but I'm in too deep. I know I care about insects and violence, and every baseline is my kind of silence. Everybody says that I gotta get a grip, but unless I let sanity give me the slip.
Bonkers.
Some people think I'm bonkers, but I just think I'm free, and I'm just living my life. There's nothing crazy about me. Some people pay for thrills, but I get mine for free. Man, I'm just living my life. There's nothing crazy about me.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that is just a little bit bonkers, and we get our thrills for free. And we also get Tony Farrell here for free as well. And here's another question I've got to ask you as well. What exactly is it about the police force? Because I think that it's like, when you get inducted into it, I know that you weren't actually a quote-unquote real police officer, but you must have seen the environment and how it works on people. And I talked to a number of police, both male and female, of course, and it seems to be that the reason why good people go in is because they actually want to help people, they want to keep society in order. But there's also another section of people who go in there not because they're good people, but because they're real scumbags. And they actually want the power to abuse and hurt people. How do those people even stay in there? And more to the point, if those people are there, how do the good people justify staying in there themselves? You know, I just don't get it.
Well, I think you've got to look at the secrecy within the service, the hierarchical structure, and the extent to which people will go to in order to climb up that hierarchical rank to high places, where because of the structure, the hierarchy, it's incredible the amount of control that's imposed on the lower ranks. And police officers, by and large, are very courageous. They at the lower ranks, they're well-meaning, or they come in as well-meaning, and they want to do a good job. The vast majority of police officers, for instance, aren't particularly interested in climbing to the dizzy ranks of a chief constable or a deputy or even a chief commander. But what we get is that the courage that police officers have to display to protect life and limb, and you know, a 5'10" police officer would think nothing of bringing down a 6'6" thug who's actually committing a burglar or beating somebody up. They go in very dangerous situations without fear or favour, and they will come to the rescue of the public in those circumstances, by and large. However, the exact reverse seems to be true when police officers are called to stand up against the evil they might see within. And that because of the hierarchical structure, if a boss gives an order out, it's a question of how high do you want me to jump, sir? And when it comes to standing up against the orders from above, it's almost like they've got a sacred cow that they have to obey, and that any disobedience is something that they wouldn't contemplate, because I believe they tend to put their own reputation, their own welfare, first and foremost, and that they know if there's any kind of act of insubordination with a service like that risks having them outing from the service in no uncertain terms, and they're not prepared to sacrifice their pension and their career for that purpose. So it's a case of, I think, the survival of the fittest. You know, these people who are hungry for power that come in there first, by and large, don't get the top for being, you know, with one or two exceptions, don't get at the top of the organisation by being nice, friendly, decent, honourable people. You know, they will have had to have actually entertained some kind of skullduggery in order to actually climb up that ladder that is quite competitive at the expense of others. And common purpose training, which is a feature in the United Kingdom, I remember my last week in the police force before I actually knew I had to make the stance. And as a principal intelligence analyst, we joined principal analysts were occasionally once or twice a year invited to conferences in which we'd meet up with our peers in other police forces. So we'd have a gathering for a day or two with fellow principal intelligence analysts in order to discuss the intelligence function within the national intelligence model of UK policing in law enforcement. And one of the things I noticed was that we were given insight and a day's tuition on the play, the Shakespearean play Julius Caesar. And it was put in terms of how we actually increase our sphere of influence. And the focus of that was not so much any kind of moral values. The focus of that was being as positioning yourself to use other people in order to climb the digi ranks and become as influential as you could possibly be, irrespective of moral standards. So gone was any kind of ethics. Gone was any kind of business ethics completely in the kind of tuition. Now, at the time, I didn't recognise this as a label as common purpose training. But I believe, looking back with hindsight now, that in essence was part of the unfolding common purpose agenda that has been rippling right through the United Kingdom public sector organisations. And we're not talking just the police, we're talking the judiciary, we're talking the public services and the National Health Service. And because of this common purpose training, which teaches you, encourages you to extend beyond your reach, extend beyond your normal boundaries and your remit to do work and business, this is now leading to power mad, power crazy people who are actually hell bent on being part of this elite. And I think they're duped and they're fooled that it's going to serve them well in the long run. In the end, I believe it will be quite the reverse.
Kind of like a deal with the devil. You think you're getting everything you ever dreamed for, but the reality is you're losing everything that makes you you, and you wind up with nothing. That's the ultimate thing that people need to recognise. And I see this in gang culture of all kinds. I believe the police force also has a similar structure to gang culture, is that you've got to look up to the leader, you've got to do what he says. And eventually, you'll figure out, if you're a good person and you're onto it, that you really don't want to be part of this anymore, that it's not actually really going to provide you with a life worth living at the end of the day. And hopefully you can get off without being pulled back in the Godfather sense of the word. But in the police force, I mean, they can't force you to come back to the police force if you quit, right? It's not that kind of thing. It's more like the fear of leaving is what keeps people inside. Fear of losing their pension, losing their career, and so on and so forth. Well, I don't know about you, man, but I'm never going to put on a black uniform and bust into innocent people's houses and take them off to camps and what have you. That would be required of somebody in a position similar to that, maybe when the Shiite Muslim hits the fans, as it were. So I'd never be able to even contemplate going into the police force, because I know that that might wind up being a possibility someday. Others, it's kind of like a mixture of naivete, right? You go in and you believe the propaganda. We're the ones who keep order in the place. We're the ones who catch bad criminals. We're the ones who protect innocent people. The problem is, I see countless instances where the police are in fact not protecting the people, but more to the point, the very ones that prey on them. You ever notice that?
How the employment opportunity is basically the opposite of what its stated goal is. And this is the similar thing with many institutions, you know. Judiciary, what are you supposed to do? Oh, you're supposed to punish the guilty. Well, therefore, you're obviously supposed to let the guilty go and punish the innocent. If you're a police officer, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to protect the innocent and catch the guilty. So obviously you're supposed to demonize the innocent and let the guilty parties go, and so on and so forth. Not like in a 100% this is exactly how it is type of thing, but in many cases, sure.
Yeah, there's institutional denial all around. And I know in the United Kingdom, many of the policies by police forces is that they will not ever investigate the judiciary and the legal establishment. So if they won't do that, they've got those sacred cows that are untouchable. And what we're seeing in the United Kingdom in particular here is that the emergence of the secret family courts, which are not just sort of stealing away young children away from families on the flimsiest of evidence, all based on foreigners coming over and giving expert witness statements that really don't hold up to scrutiny. But the agenda seems to be to destroy the family, to destroy family values, and to make money through a utterly corrupt social services that has power beyond imagination. And that's what we're seeing as a movement within the United Kingdom. The secret courts are very dangerous. They're even jailing people in secret without a jury for the slightest sort of wrongdoing and a breach of a secret family court order. And this is a deeply worrying trend, and that the police are unwilling to do nothing. And I know my own police force, I know cases that they have been involved with, in particular the Vicky Hay case, which is an incredible case I won't have time to go into. But she's just been sent back to jail, given that her daughter was... the evidence against her daughter being child abused by a former partner was compelling. And in the end, instead of actually arresting and putting before the Crown Prosecution Service the merits of the case based on testimonies, what happens is Vicky Hague gets tricked, gets told to back down, and then when she backs down, she gets sent to jail for a breach of a non-molestation order, because the judge is slapping her. Well, if you're changing your story, you're actually emotionally abusing your daughter. And she was tricked by her own legal team into that process, and now she's been sent back to a jail for a second time. And a more loving woman, a lady, a mother, you could not wish to find. So, and that comes back into my own backyard in South Yorkshire Police. It's incredible. There is one thing I did, which I'll tell you about. Last week, I sent an email to over 500 police officers in my own police service. And in that email, it opened up a link to one of the finest speeches I've heard about. It was the chairperson of Everton Football Club. Everton Football Club sits side by side Liverpool Football Club in the city of Liverpool, two big clubs in the United Kingdom. And it was in relation to the Hillsborough disaster in 1989 that I've already spoken about. And in this speech by the chairman of Everton, he made an impassioned plea for justice and the truth in front of a packed out stadium at Liverpool Anfield. And it was very emotional. I even wept when I heard that speech. And he opened it up with a passage from Philippians. So moved was I that I sliced and diced that speech and sent it with a nice covering letter through to South Yorkshire Police, who, for people that don't know, the disclosure issues are now coming to the fore, and that there is likely to be criminal investigation because at least 116 police officers have been found to change statements from back in 1989, and the whole thing has covered it up, or up until recent times. And sadly for me, all those emails got underneath the radar and hit every single police officer that I intended to do. And I thought this will hopefully touch the hearts and minds of the police officers who are not to blame for Hillsborough, but are operating within an organisation that is at, quite clearly, a moral crossroads. They have been found wanting And the days are numbered if they don't actually change their ways. But you know what, Vinny? Only 12 individuals were willing to spend 6 minutes to look at that beautiful, scripted YouTube speech on a very momentous occasion and heartwarming occasion for a population who, for 24 years, have fought tooth and nail for justice. And it's a much maligned population, the families and the supporters of the 96 that died. And time again, they got pilloried by the media in the United Kingdom, but everything that they have done has been vindicated. And even now, even today, South Yorkshire Police are very loath to repent and come clean and declare what really happened and put these Liverpool supporters and the families who lost their loved ones out of their misery. All they want now, that they can't bring back their loved ones, but what they seek is truth, first and foremost. And then beyond truth, they seek justice in some way. And at the moment, we've not had a single police officer brought to book about the massive cover-up of Hillsborough. I myself have got my own theories about why they did Hillsborough.
Well, let's discuss that after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. You know, to be honest, I'd never actually heard of the Hillsborough disaster, and after the break I want to actually discuss it a little bit more and inform me about what actually happened there. We'll be right back with Tony. We'll be right back with Tony Farrell, ladies and gentlemen, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. It's the final segment right here with Tony Farrell on the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and he's going to enlighten me, and maybe quite likely enlighten the rest of you too, about what exactly the Hillsborough tragedy was.
Yes, Vinnie, it was the second year in succession that a football FA Cup semi-final was played between Nottingham Forest and Liverpool, and it was played at a neutral venue, which happened to be Hillsborough Sheffield. And the year before, in 1988, there were problems at the Leppings Lanes end, where people were reporting that they felt totally crushed. But the police never really took action upon that. Anyway, on the day itself, on the 15th of April 1989, Liverpool were given the Leppings Lane end again, the second time in succession. And there was a misprint on the tickets, deliberate otherwise, to get to the ground by 15 minutes to 3 o'clock kickoff. Now, there was only 6 turnstiles to funnel people through. So there was a mad rush outside the stadium and people were getting crushed. So a decision was made to open up the gate and let the Liverpool supporters in. Now, there were at the stadium itself, at the end, the Leppings Lane then was sectioned into 3 pens, but they all went through, a vast majority went through the middle pen. And that this was at a time when there was problems with football hooliganism in the United Kingdom, and it was all, see, the stadiums were generally speaking all standing, or proportion was standing, and that all the crowd funnel through to the central stadium behind the goalposts. And because there was wire netting at the front, there was no overspill. And therefore, people got crushed in the process, massively so, and it was horrific. And the police froze on the day and were very slow to pull the wiring down to allow escape over onto the pitch. In the end, 96 people were killed, crushed to death. And then there followed a massive campaign against the Liverpool supporters that they were drunk, they were urinating over police officers who were trying to give them the, you know, help people kiss the life and resuscitate them. And all this was a fabrication put out by South Yorkshire Police senior management that was picked hold of by the mainstream media, in particular the Rupert Murdoch's Sun newspaper, And even today, the Sun newspaper is not purchased in Liverpool, so disgusted were they with the lies. And the debt of the 96 was by and large covered up, and the South Yorkshire Police went to great lengths to distance themselves from any blame. Now, there were three inquiries. The most recent one, the Lord Justice Taylor, Stuart Smith, all showing evidence that the police changed statements, but it was as if, well, so what? And I believe, first and foremost, that in a way that was a deliberate sacrifice, and we have to look at, examine qui bono, who benefits. Because what subsequently happened, and the first inquiry was Lord Justice Taylor's, it focused on the ground improvement on health and safety. But what the effect it had was that it made Premiership football all-seater stadiums at a time when we were in recession. And now you've got a multi-billion pound industry in the Premiership football, which is probably the biggest sort of football league in the world at the moment, where a massive amount of money has poured in over the last decade. None of that would have happened under Margaret Thatcher's regime were it not for the fact that we had this disaster. Now, back to why it was all covered up, and why I know, for instance, even today it's still covered up, is because on the 20th anniversary, I wasn't really particularly attuned to Hillsborough as a principal intelligence analyst. It never came on my radar. But the press officer, Andy Hymas, sat with me in a canteen on the 20th anniversary looking completely shell-shocked. The reason why he was shell-shocked, he'd been in front of the chief constable that day facing the press on the 20th anniversary. And when he was sat with me over a lunch, he told me this story because he had been in working for South Yorkshire Police in the ground on the day itself of the disaster. And he told me that he'd been told to get to the control room, which had all the CCTV showing the horror unfold of people getting crushed to death, that was manned by police officers. When he made his way to the control room, they wouldn't let him in, the police officers, even though he was a member of South Yorkshire Police and a senior one at that. He was told in no uncertain terms when he relayed the message back to break the door down if he had to. He must get inside. And when he got inside, he realised why they were so reluctant to let him in the first place. It was because the highest ranking officer on the day, ACC Walter Jackson, was a gibbering wreck underneath the table and had lost the plot. Now, none of that came out in any disclosures. Even today, former ACC Assistant Chief Constable Walter Jackson is unblemished, untainted by the Hillsborough disaster, and yet he crumbled on the day for whatever reason. And the evil thing about that is that it's been covered up, and even after three inquiries, none of that has been exposed. And all those people in the control room would have had to put witness statements in. If they were truthful, they would have named and shamed Walter Jackson, but that never happened.
You know, this is something about politics that really frustrates me. Whenever they want something covered up or not viewed by the public, they will either conduct an investigation or appoint a commission. And the investigation and the commission are basically there to ensure that it's covered up.
That's right, yeah. And this is the one. This has gone on for 24 years, and it would have been dead and buried only for the fact that the tenacity shown by a single community in getting together, forcing the government to do something about this by way of petition, by way of incessant campaigning for the truth, that has overcome the evil within. And I was there. It was a privilege to be at the House of Commons debate in which the families were all there, and that the politicians, quickly playing up to the gallery, turned 180 degrees away from any blame attached to the Liverpool fans, but squarely laying the blame on the media, the Sun, Murdoch, and also South Yorkshire Police. That's entirely justified, given the cover-up. But it's very sad for me. I was a Liverpool supporter as a lad. I'm not particularly interested in football these days. But it was very sad for me to realise that my force that I'd worked for 17 years, a joiner service in 93, 4 years after Hillsborough, had covered all that up. Now, my story about Andy Hymas, he had no reason to tell me a lie on that 20th anniversary. I believe it to be true, exactly. But it was corroborated by another chap, a BBC radio, local radio reporter, a guy called Winston Cooper, who had the same story to tell about Walter Jackson. But on the 15th of April 2011, or 2012, I can't remember which now, he was murdered in France. So on the very and allegedly it was his son that murdered him in a very vicious death. But that death, because Winston Cooper was the guy that told, that spilled the beans in front of a colleague of mine, David Pidcock, who's the leader of the UK Islamic Party for Britain and resides in Sheffield and has been, together we've been very critical of South Yorkshire Police's role in Hillsborough. Winston Cooper, the guy that died, the father that died, we believe that his death was very suspicious because he had the power to expose this story of Walter Jackson.
That didn't by chance happen in a tunnel in Paris as well.
Yeah, well, there's a film out there about Princess Diana and it contains damning evidence. But the establishment, the YouTube, they're all taking it down whenever it's but believe you me, all the evidence points to the fact that Princess Diana was whacked too, and it was deliberate. And
We've got only a minute or two left in the broadcast, and we have a caller on the line. I'd like to just quickly take that caller. You've got about 60 seconds or so. Colston, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Vinny. How are you?
Yeah, somewhat fabulous, man.
Good. Yeah, it's good to hear you. We haven't talked in a while. Anyway, fabulous show tonight. And the reason why I called was because my computer crapped out on me, and the only way I can listen is through the phone right now. But so I didn't have any general question. I just wanted to say it's a great show, and your guest is really enlightening us tonight. That's all I wanted to say.
All right, Colston. Thank you for your call.
Keep up the good work, my friend.
Thank you very much, Colston.
Take care.
All right. Well, that brings us pretty much to the end of the show then. Tony, we just want to quickly get out your website as well, the farrellreport.net. That's Farrell with two R's and two L's, the farrellreport.net. And thanks very much for your time, man, and anything you'd like to say in the last 30 seconds?
Well, just to thank you, Vinny, for the second opportunity I've had to appear on your wonderful show. I'm very grateful. And in terms of a final message, I just feel as though, I'll repeat that phrase, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. We all have a part to play in exposing the truth and winning the hearts and minds. Thank you.
Yeah. And I think that's basically my philosophy as well. You know, you don't have to do anything perfect or correctly or right or whatever. You know, just do what you feel is right and just don't do nothing. Because you know what's going to happen if you do nothing, right? Nothing! It's pretty straightforward. If you do something, something happens. You know, it's the nature of the universe. Physics, if you will, you know. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So if you sit there and you don't take any actions, there ain't going to be any reactions. You know what I'm saying? Sick of people convincing themselves that it's a brilliant idea to sit around and do absolutely nothing and allow other people to do the fighting for them. It's stupid. It's lazy. It's inept. And it's frickin' scumbaggery at its worst, I think. You know, there's only one thing worse than a scumbag who tries to destroy people's lives and cover it up. And that's the scumbags who know that it's going on and choose to convince themselves to do nothing. This show is listener-supported. Please donate. Please subscribe. And we'll see you again sometime.